menado batagot sa gumba mo yeye sa gara. Kudundo mo marude kudara nyate. Menado batagot sa gumba mo yeye sa gara. So go there for the year, there for the surat,
really sweet, sweet, sweet salsa music coming right out of the deepest part of Senegal. Yes, that's the group Africando with Sagu. It's interesting. I mean, their salsa is just hypnotic. And it's every now and then I throw that in to get people a little, wait a minute, that's not Spanish I'm hearing. No, it's not. It's Wolof and the group Africando. They've been around for quite a while. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, July 10th. We start a little late today, but let me give you a heads up. Today is open forum. I got a lot of reaction yesterday. People saying, "Well, you know, it took too long with some of your callers, and the traffic got backed up." So, as a concession, we say, "Okay, let's get whatever it is you need said today." We always want to extend to you the opportunity to express your opinions, because this is part of the work of education. You know, we trade thoughts and opinions with each other, and it is really not important whether one agrees or disagrees, really. Your opinions are your own. It's important, though, to be prepared to defend a position. And to understand that what is happening in the transaction is that we try to get to a common understanding of things. The final opinion and final thoughts, of course, everybody is entitled to that bit of sovereignty to make up your own mind. But in the course of discussion, we're interested in connecting with each other at a particular level. And the star of that show is information, not ego. So 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Quite a number of things to talk about, but I am traffic cop and occasional questioner. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I just also want, while you're getting your calls organized, I want to also remind you that we have this project, a continuing project. It has not yet happened, but we are very concerned about the plight of children in Haiti. Since the earthquake 3 years ago, conditions under which people are living have just improved only just in a micrometer sense. But by and large, life is very desperate, and especially for these children. Their relatives here, stateside in the United States, have made applications to the government to reclaim their children and relatives and to support them through the process of Haiti's rebuilding. And that was cleared. It was supposed to be okay, and it received clearance from everybody. But for some reason, the Department of Homeland Security simply has not followed through. And quite a few lives have already been lost. So we're asking that you call Frederica Wilson. She is a congresswoman representing a congressional district with the largest population of Haitians in the United States, and that is in the Miami area. Her office number is 202 202- 202-225-4506, 202-225-4506. Call her, please, and very politely and very respectfully request that she urge the president to instruct the Department of Homeland Security to get this program started. The children are in very serious trouble. And a phone call is what it takes to register concern. It doesn't cost us anything, but it does indicate that we are advocating in the interest of children who are totally defenseless at this point and don't deserve to live this way. Nobody does, but especially children. So do make an effort and make a call and, you know, join in a pretty decent thing. You know, you'd sleep better tonight if you make your call. 202-225-4506. It is a project I'm very concerned about because, of course, you know, these children have no real political clout, so they're ignored. Everybody's ignoring children. That's so sad. So there you go. All right. 888-874-4888. Let's get down to business. What are you thinking about? What are your thoughts? What are your opinions? What do you have to say? The time is available to you. The bullhorn is available to you. You have your own soapbox, so stand on it and let's hear what you've got to say. I like the idea of people, interacting with each other. Not too long ago, when I did my program elsewhere, I would have people, put two or three people on the line together. It was really magic listening to them trade thoughts with each other. And we just listen in. It was a really incredible way to do radio. We'll get there, but we just have to get to the idea of getting used to presenting to the public what we're thinking. Some people are a bit reticent about that, and I understand that. But, hey, we all have to start somewhere. I could read you, for example, a reaction I got. Let me see here. I got quite a bit. But this one I actually am going to respond to. I have responded to personally. I like to try and get answers to people as quickly as I can. And this was a caller who was, I think, the last caller we had yesterday, David, and we just didn't get through. But he was of the opinion, that I was not fair about Snowden. And frankly, it really doesn't matter what I think. It really doesn't matter what I think about Snowden. I have my thoughts, and others do. But I posit the theory about it because it affords us an opportunity. What is going on now, it affords an opportunity to deconstruct this notion of race and race privilege. And clearly, I mean, to deny that that is a factor is to deny the reality to me. I mean, that I just see it that way. There is a way to look at life, and it is natural. This is part of the work, I think, that the so-called progressive or liberal or whatever it is community you want to call it, we have to do. Because the tendency is, I mean, the way we are enculturated in our society, we drag along our enculturation wherever we go. So if it is natural for someone to be basically conscious of the idea of privilege and you internalize that, it's not that you're being bad, you're just behaving the way you are enculturated. The way you are taught to behave, the way you see the world that's your natural view. Of course, it's not a natural view, but it is your view. And you see the world that way. Hello, Michael from Jersey. How are you today?
I'm good, Eutrice, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here.
I wanted to say firstly that I do really appreciate the approach that you've been taking with regard to Edward Snowden from the beginning, and in emphasizing the racial aspect of that, showing that there's a differential treatment and pointing out white privilege. And as examples, you told us about the COINTEL program, which we all remember, and why wasn't there so much, you know, action at that point? And why did the press not, you know, call out at that time? And why did we have to wait for Ken Burns to enlighten us, as you suggested? And the Central Park jogger case, which is also relevant. But also, I think there's a difference as well that goes beyond the racial aspect, where there's a difference in the kind of surveillance that was going on then versus now. No, not the surveillance itself, but there is a difference in that I think now it's being institutionalized in the sense that I'm connecting it to these secret courts and these secret judicial judgments that no one knows about. There was an article, was it yesterday, the day before, in the New York Times, in the op-ed part of the paper that suggested, that was talking about these, you know, that in talking about the secret courts and the whole surveillance things, we don't know what we're talking about because we don't know what they've written. Because it's secret. And I'd like to ask, what is the place in us, in our society, for courts making, for secret courts making secret laws outside the adversarial process of our legal system, and with only one side in the courtroom and no one to be able to review the laws? And maybe a few people in Congress know about it, but they're under a gag order as well, because you know, every time there's national security is touched upon, everything is thrown into a black hole that's outside of our system. And I think this black hole has a very great danger to suck all of us up into it. I'd like to just put a quote in here, and this is a quote by James Madison in 1788. "There are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. And I think that's relevant also, because this is something that's been, you know, creeping and sort of, you know, the press kind of, you know, shed some light on it, and there's some outrage about it, and then they may have to give up something, and then they go right back into it in a more severe way. And so, you know, I question this whole business of the secretism creating a divide between the people on the one hand and government on the other hand. And I think this divide is what sort of brings down civilizations.
Well, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. The whole issue of secrecy, I understand and appreciate to some degree that government, one of the responsibilities of a government is, of course, national security. I understand that. In fact, that was a huge point by Madison and others in trying to persuade the states to not be afraid of the issue of federalism, that one of the main issues of federalism was to provide a common defense. So I get that. All countries should have some notion of defense and some idea of what is best for the country. In the way that things have evolved, we have, I mean, it's lunacy, but you have a transition from a total open warfare to what they call the Cold War era. But in the meantime, you have an industry that requires warlike behavior, and you have a national psychology that requires warlike behavior in order to maintain dominance. So it feeds itself. It's like a self-feeding bacteria. You can't get rid of that mentality, because that is exactly the mentality that is the leftover from the war years, when certain things were to be secret, you know, loose lips sink ships and all of that stuff. The internalization of a code of behavior that basically was predicated on war. The ensuing years after the war, they did not decelerate that kind of thinking, because even though there were not bombing places and other people looking to bomb us and everybody looking to bomb each other, in the real literal sense, it was transformed. Warfare was transformed, and the war mentality still operates. And that's exactly what we have today. And that is why the Obama administration is no different from any other administration in this regard. It maintains the same mentality. We must dominate. We must be the superpower. And so secrecy is natural.
Right, but has it creeped into an institutionalization in our political institutional systems, this secret court that issues secret judgments, you know, laws.
Of course it has crept in, because authorized the secret courts?
But there was only one side in the courtroom. It's not the court, that the legal system that we understand, which is an adversarial system. There's
only one side
in the courtroom. It's the government making the laws and promulgating them and making it by fiat.
Now, in their view, that's perfectly natural, because you have secret courts operating at the lower level. That's what a grand jury is. It's a secret court. You know, a grand jury is not open to the public, and it's only for the prosecutor. There's only one side. So we see it all over the place. We don't recognize it, but we see it. It's all over the place. The mentality is what's wrong. The mentality is so evil, and it's so pervasive, and it's universal. It is very, very difficult for the United States to transition out of its warlike psychology and the need to dominate, because the need to dominate requires this kind of crazy behavior. You have to be secret about it. This is war. This is warlike behavior. You're plotting against the enemy, because somebody's going to come and get you. And the more you seek to dominate, the more terrified you are about anybody encroaching on your turf, anybody likely to attack you, anybody who seeks to compete with you for world domination. That is the mentality. So secrecy is not a stranger to us. We encounter it every day. And in fact, in some cases, we think it's very, very good. We have lots of secret things that are part of our normal, normal way we operate.
Right. The only difference I was trying to make, and I'd like to talk about this psychological thing too, but I'll let somebody else go on. I don't want to take up too much time.
Right. We have Ben from Cape May waiting.
Okay. The difference was I was trying to make was that, you know, back in the COINTELPRO, we always had this secrecy and the spies, you know, the James Bond stuff going on. But I think they're trying to institutionalize it now, and that's what's scary to me.
But they never stopped institutionalizing it. Look, the point I'm making is the intent has not changed at all. The function has not changed at all. The purpose has not changed at all. The intention has not changed at all from the word go. So whether the technology at one point was limited to literally getting a bunch of people to go out and see what other people are doing, come back and file reports, or whether on the, you know, with the advent of radio waves, they began to find a more convenient way to spy, it has always been part of the psychology and the apparatus of government. What is different today
is that the
technology has enabled to the government to literally satisfy its greed by now expanding more and more and more and more into areas that it couldn't before, because it's now technologically possible. And you know, this is part of my theory about Snowden, and I'm seeing this as a development. I think part of it, of course, he knew he was about to be nabbed. I think he knew they were onto him. But I believe there is, and it's not being said, but just my nose for news. It's quite possible that throughout the world there is an emergence of an organization of Edward Snowden's, and they are organizing, in their view, a counterattack, a cyber counterattack on their own. They're developing ways to challenge governments and bring them down. And this is what is accounting for the relentless capture. I believe that there is, not just in the United States, I think in the United Kingdom, in Russia, in China, and so forth, there are people who are enmeshed in the bowels of the, you know, top secret areas, and they have decided that. I mean, it's a warped way of thinking, because it's not inspired by, it's inspired initially by the idea of doing good, but it is also inspired by the flip side of the same coin. Everybody wants to be powerful, and this is a new kind of power. I did say to you before that if you listen to Julian Assange, you get the idea that he's perfectly comfortable as president of a virtual nation. He acts like a president of a virtual nation. And this may just be the emergence of a new kind of warfare, a new kind of power grab by people who initially are really, really concerned about the overarching powers of and unchecked powers of government. But on the flip side, of course, they may themselves be imitating its worst characteristics.
A new tyranny.
Yes, yes, indeed. And we see it here. We did a program, you remember, called "The New Oligarchs," and they look like Snowden.
Yeah, that's...
these are so. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for your conversation, Ben from Cape May. Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking about all these whistleblowers. Yes, you hear me?
Yes.
We're talking about all these new whistleblowers. There's a new Huffington Post article on Russ Tice. You might remember her. You might remember him from 2005. He blew the whistle on Bush's surveillance. He's a top NSA analyst, former NSA analyst, and
yes.
Now he's come forward and he's reporting that the NSA has in the past, when he was there, ordered wiretaps and surveillance on high-ranking military officials, lawmakers, and diplomats, including, according to him, Barack Obama. Back in 2004, his Senate office. Think about the consequences of that. Think how that completely changes the dynamic of our supposedly democratic political system. When you have this sort of almost Nazi-like surveillance system where people are spying on their political enemies. It's completely
I have to ask you, Ben. I imagine that you have a sense of history about these things. Is this new?
This is not new. No, this goes back way back in history. This was done in Soviet Russia. This was done in Nazi Germany.
And so why, I have to ask you now, if it's not new, because this is critical, you recognize it's not new. They know it's not new. But why is there such an effort to make it look like this is new?
I don't know. I think that in today's society, we really fail to compare and contrast historical events to current events to the degree that we should, because history does repeat itself. We study history, but when we're studying history, we should really think about, we should also be studying current events and seeing what are the parallels to what's going on today. That's what students should be doing in high school and college. When they study history, they should be studying current events at the same time and saying, what trends are repeating and what, how do we change this trend? And you know, why is it repeating and how do we prevent it from repeating again? That's the primary question of history.
Why is that important?
It's important because if you understand the formulas by which human beings progress as a society from a free and democratic nation into a more and more corrupt, oligarchical, more tyranny-like system, if you understand the means by which it becomes that way, you can prevent it. And if you understand what nations in history have become the most prosperous and the most free, you can repeat those same formulas to once again make the United States a more freer and democratic nation. Those have been perfect, and also help other countries become free and democratic. We always try to do that overseas. We tried to do it in Iraq. We tried to do it in Afghanistan. For the most part, it's failed miserably. We try to do it, but for the most part, we end up overthrowing democratically elected representatives in foreign countries and third world countries, and installing dictators. We put Saddam into power. We put the original dictator in Egypt to power. We put the president of Libya into power, and then we have to go back in 20, 30 years later, and we have to overthrow him. We never successfully have created a free, besides Japan. Japan, for whatever reason, it was one instance where we overthrew a tyranny, and somehow it became a relatively free and democratic nation. So we can learn something from Japan. I'm not sure what.
What I was trying to get at, Ben, was that the flip side of the coin is really where the issue is, where you meet it. And the flip side of the coin, you're correct. If you were to provide context, if you were to provide a historical, as you say, a comparative analysis, people would have a sense of this has been going on for a long time. Now, it is in the interest of government, it is the interest of media to lift things out of context because it serves a purpose. If you are under the impression, as many people are today, that the NSA and other covert actions are so new, you know, you get their attention, and they were because this is a problem that just cropped up. But if they were really to wrap their minds around the fact that this is an age-old problem, what do you think the reaction of the American people would be, like we just talked about? If it were said, and Michael from Jersey had referenced COINTELPRO, but it goes way beyond that. It goes literally at the beginnings of this nation. It has been so uniformly intact, this mentality. If people were to really wrap their brains around this thing, what do you think the reaction would be if they said, my God, what is it that, you know, this thing continues to exist after all these years?
Oh, it'd be complete outrage. You would see what happened in Egypt with 14 million people on the streets. You would see that in the United States. In Egypt, they get out, they've gotten out in the streets. They were tired of the terrible governing which took place, the poor excuse for governing that took place in Egypt. And they got out in the streets and they demanded change, and occurred. And at least they had the spirit. I don't know what's going to happen in Egypt, but they get out in the streets, and perhaps if they had a little more historical context and they had more wisdom that was gained by it, they'd be able to elect someone who was actually a populist candidate and was going to work for the best interest of Egypt as a whole. If people had a so-called conscience, the first thing we would do is we'd get out in the streets. We would be calling up our congressmen. We would be demanding that they restore the First Amendment, restore the Fourth Amendment, and they take sensible measures to combat terrorism, namely by improving our foreign policy so that people do not hate us overseas. Because everything that we're experiencing is blowback, I'm sorry to say. So we are constantly reacting to the problems that we created in the first place.
Good point. Excellent point. Thank you, Ben. Thanks
for
your contribution today. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Jay from New York, you're up next.
Oh, good afternoon, Utrecht.
Good afternoon. Fine, thank you.
Good. Yesterday you had a caller from New York that was speaking about Chokwe Lumumba. And
yes.
She made the comment that he was just elected the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama. She was wrong.
Yes.
It's Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi, yes.
Right.
Yes.
You know, the reason why I'm basically calling is because with these elections of people like Chokwe Lumumba, we sometime in our community become very enthused and, you know, elated by these people getting into office. But the thing that I've seen what's been going on in North Carolina and South Carolina and these other southern states, Yet, in certain parts of those states, people are able to get elected. But on the whole, the Republicans are able to put into place measures which cause great harm.
Why are you singling out Republicans doing great harm?
Oh no! You didn't let me finish my point. I was getting ready to get.
Sorry,
to the
my bad.
I mean? The Democrats also play a part in it, also because they wish to do one thing. They wish to be able to keep their seat and their position.
I want to ask you a question about, I mean, in your opening statements, you talked about Chokwe Lumumba being elected in Jackson, Mississippi. But you said right after that, you talked about, you know, these people being elected, you've had some, I'm reading there that you have some doubts as to whether this would change anything with these people being elected. Why do you have such a pessimistic view of even activists like Chokwe Lumumba being elected?
Well, the reason why I'm so pessimistic about them doing anything if they get into office, in all honesty, is because we seem to not collectively be able to come together to do what's in our best interests. I mean, We seem to believe that these political figures are gonna do something to make our lives better. You know,
for example, that he is Chokwe Lumumba, who, by the way, has had a consistent record of involvement at the community level, and has had a consistent history of fighting, I mean, really tough battles, both in court and outside of court.
Yeah.
So do you see that as a plus, or do you see that even so, with his record, his established record, that even he might be susceptible, or do you have at least a little bit of faith that perhaps that record established all these years would continue?
I have the faith that if we as a people come together collectively to support him and we have an agenda for him to implement, then maybe he could make changes. To look for him to make changes just based on what he feels is best for us will not work. And that, and I think that's what's happened with the president in office. We have no real consensus of an agenda and of what we need to do to make ourselves as a people more whole.
But I think you could appreciate the difference here.
But
Chokwe Lumumba.
See, the thing is, I appreciate both sides of it. I think that Chokwe will do good things. But the only way he will be able to do good things is if the people support him when he tries to do these things, instead of becoming scared and intimidated when people start to make judgment about what Chokwe is doing. That's the history of us. We become scared of what other people think and say when we're doing things in our best interest. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I agree with that. The instructive thing about Chokwe Lumumba's candidacy and his success at being elected is that he has illustrated, his candidacy and his election have illustrated the mindset that has to occur across America, and especially across America's most oppressed and marginalized communities. And that is to make a definitive distinction between the process of selection and the process of election. When people are asked to vote, typically, it is because the selection has already been made by the party. But if you select your own candidate and you are part of that process of grooming candidates and you bring them along and you have organic links with them and they with you, and you create your own political alternative to the party process, then you have meaningful political process going, because the process of selection is in line with the process of election. But, you know, that's just not the way it works in most communities.
But that's what we suffer from.
Yes, I agree.
We don't realize that to have someone like Chokwe in office is an example of what we need to be part of the system. But it's our job to support him, not to just get him in the office. Now that he's in office, to have his back when these people go at him. And this is what has caused somewhat of a problem on the national level. But, you know, all politics is local. And if we were to be able to build those type of coalitions that Chokwe has and then supported them in the local arena, then you could stop the broader appeal from being able to just ram things down your throat, like in North Carolina and South Carolina. Because if the people were collectively together in their districts and in their communities and were voting, you would be in the position to stop those that have a little bit of political leverage and power above you from implementing the type of things that cause drastic harm to all communities.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for your input
today. Have a good
day,
Eutrice.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you so much for calling. 888-874-4888. Today is makeup day because we didn't give you enough space yesterday. So here you are. You have your bullhorn and your soapbox. You're ready to go. 888-874-4888. You know, while I'm waiting for other calls to come in, I want to go back to what Michael said. It was very, very profound. And that is that we still have to understand that the country has never relieved itself of its war mentality. It started that way. It started as a nation of domination, both domestically and internationally. That is its psychology. It makes no difference who's in the White House. That is the overarching philosophy and psychology that everything fits into. And like I said, I mean, if we are opposed to secret processes, but we have a grand jury, we're opposed to secret courts at the federal level, but we have secret courts every day. And it's a one-sided affair. So you see, when you start linking these things up, you see how we actually are conditioned to live with contradiction. And we don't question it because it's so normal. You know, I was myself talking about the fact that the Trayvon Martin case was a case that should have been brought before the grand jury. This is a case that required grand jury investigation. But I'm arguing in that sense that the initial thing wrong with this case is that at that court level, which is secret, okay, it is a secret court, at that level, justice would have prevailed in this case or could prevail in this case. And of course, it's exactly at that point that it didn't. Now, technically, I'm making the argument that a secret court would have been of benefit here. So you see, flip sides of the same coin. On the one hand, we can't tolerate secret courts. On the other hand, we find them necessary. And we look to them for justice. That's the eternal conundrum of living in this country. You have to, you know, it's gray. It's gray, masses and masses of gray. And you always have to sort through it to see, of this huge amount of gray that confronts us every single day, how much of that gray is black? How much of that gray is white? It's never a cut and dried black and white thing. Very seldom do we have such stark choices to make. Most often, we have to sift through the debris and see if we could find or salvage anything that is of value, that is pristine. And, you know, life isn't pristine. It isn't at all. 888-874-4888. Who's up next? Let's see. Oh, we have people queuing up. But this is the kind of conversation that we need to be having. So that when we start talking serious, you know, serious political talk, we understand that we are dealing with major imperfections from the start. No idealistic things going on here. I mean, idealism is out the window. Whatever exists as ideals themselves are not ideal. But the idea that we should be talking through is how do we confront all of these contradictions, because that's what they are. On a daily basis, we have to deal with these things in a mature way without anybody, you know, seeing that, well, it has to be this way or it has to be that way. There are many, many ways to go. Until I started talking, for example, about the historical context of even the, you know, marriage equality issue is rooted in the efforts of African Americans to marry in this country. They were denied that. That is legal historical reference. So that even when people are celebrating same-sex marriage and so forth, the correct thing that we have to instruct people to start doing is to acknowledge it. You know, we acknowledge, yes, it's a great victory for the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual community. Fantastic that you were able to reference, in effect, a law that came to you through struggle by other people. And that's how it is. You see, the acknowledgement should be there. If indeed, and I'm speaking now specifically about the idea of being progressive, if we are progressive, these are the things we have to do. We acknowledge struggle that yielded good results and even bad results, but effort aimed at a benefit for all society. Don't ignore people. And don't just start seeing the world again the same one-dimensional, you know, tunnel way. It's the white way. That's really not applicable in my part of the world. It's just not going to exist. I'm not going to tolerate it. If we are progressive people, if we are enlightened people, we ought to be having a different level of conversation. That's the point I'm making. But if you're going to still hold on to the notions of privilege, you are, in fact, a walking contradiction. And every time that I encounter it, I will point it out. That's the nature of the work that we have to do. There's a lot of racism in the progressive community, a lot of sexism, a lot of gender issues, a lot of very undemocratic things are happening in our community. And people think that, you know, you just mouth the right phrases and you say the right things and you know, and that is what makes you progressive. No, it's very tough work. And you may not necessarily be too popular. You might be an irritant wherever you go. But it is important, if you're committed, to deal with it in a mature way. These are the realities that confront us. We didn't make these things happen. You know, we didn't cause these things. We didn't build these institutions. We didn't organize society this way. But we have, in any event, to navigate through it. And the only way we could navigate through it is that people become real about what the experience is at ground level. These are the experiences that are to contend with. So I want to thank you. We come to the end of our program today, and I hope that it got everybody their needs met informationally. I love these sessions. You know, this is stuff that we should do all the time, just talk. Look how much knowledge that was exchanged in this short time. I thank you very much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. I'll try really hard to be deserving of them. So we'll see each other tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Spread the word, please, that this is your preferred place to get to know what's really happening in the world today. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You want to stay right here. Bye-bye. Naladi sama bopeng segal sinma ah por bi yalla ba ta jojo tofel man ma war la won da bogi jamono da bogi jamono.